Well, you want to see where the fix is.
Okay, just hit that?
Yeah, okay. When he's done, just
okay,
hit that.
Okay, I can do that. Can handle this. I only have half a job now.
Oh. I'm sorry. Is it good? I'm going to say vice president then?
You like secretary?
Where is my submarine device? Okay, what? Submarine device. I call it that when I can't find it.
I'll be doing that.
Okay.
All I can do is nap these days. Actually, that's just a normal thing.
That's okay.
The thing about me is, I'm going to take a nap. I need my notebook out. Hold on.
Yeah, I just really enjoy it.
I wrote it down. Lecture 4, making wudu. Number 1, hand washing. Make sure to interlock fingers, and then that's all I wrote.
Are you reviewing wudu?
I was taking notes, but I...
Look at you, you took notes.
Well, I gave up, I think. And I didn't take notes on the podcast either, so just lesson 1.
And you listened to the podcast too?
Yeah, I had to catch up.
Was it making sense?
It was really good, I like it.
You're such a nice person, you should be here all the time.
I'm busy. I took goodness on the first one.
Look at that.
A student.
No, my friend wants to talk to my professor and she canceled office hours, that coward.
Did you have this piece of on an exam?
Well, he didn't like my essay.
Oh, that one.
Which was annoying because the whole point of the essay was I could write whatever I wanted.
Yeah.
And he was like, I don't like what you picked. And I was like, well, that's how this works. It's okay. It's okay.
Is that thing actually on?
Yeah.
Is it live streaming?
Yes.
Is it?
Yeah. There's two people.
Oh, no way. Wait, so should we start?
So everybody just heard my story about my essay, too.
I hope your professor isn't there.
Oh, yeah, can you imagine? I don't think he is.
Your professor is one of the two people that
actually... He's both of them. It's a burner account.
I really need to set up my new phone.
You don't need
a phone. Yeah.
No, this is the old one. I'm too lazy to...
All of them exist. Don't worry.
I'm too lazy to...
Hello. Yeah, I realized I was like just looking at the iPad.
Okay, don't take my job though.
Oh, what's your job?
I hit the X at the end.
That is all yours.
Yeah, okay. Just steer clear of the X.
Will do.
Oh, now there's one person.
Oh.
They're coming back, don't worry.
He heard all of it secure.
All right. We recorded it. I'm gonna go and be like, why'd you give me a B minus? And he'll be like, play the tape. Are you sure?
Oh,
I just see it.
if someone came out and was just a grown man.
I think we'd have to leave.
And he was like, how dare you?
Should we get started? I don't know. Yeah.
I can't find it for it.
So if you want to just take a quick minute, I don't know how many people are going to show up because we haven't done this during Ramadan before, but if you want to just kind of introduce yourselves to one another, learn people's names, maybe how Ramadan has been going so far, and then we'll get started. Yeah. If you already know the people sitting next to you, maybe trying to find a new face and introducing yourselves.
Do I know you?
Hello.
You guys can move up too.
Do I know you?
So
I think
so.
I think we had like a sister circle before.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, wait.
Right. Hello.
Hello.
Oh, I can
switch
with you.
Okay, this
you know what? I know all of you.
I know Maya's the common denominator here.
There's one upstairs and one down. It's all written on the board outside. Okay, should we get started? Bismillah. Bismillah walhamdulillah. Wassalatu wassalam ala rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa man wala. So last week we started to talk about fasting, and we were looking at the verses in Surah Al-Baqarah, the second chapter of the Quran, that speak about fasting. People want to pull those up. It's verse 183 onwards, and maybe we could have somebody just read those out loud again. From 183, through 187. Does anybody want to read? You want to read? You're like the designated reader. Yeah, let's go.
In class, I want to try to get kids to read. So.
Yeah, I know, man. Look at that.
You who believe, fasting is prescribed for you, and it is prescribed for those before you, so that you may be mindful of God. Fast for a specific number of days, but if one of you is ill or on a journey, then on other days later. For those who can fast only with extreme difficulty, there is way to compensate. Feed a needy person, but if anyone does good of his own accord, it is better for him, and fasting is better for you, if only you knew. It was in the month of Ramadan that the Quran was revealed as guidance for mankind, clear messages giving guidance and distinguishing between right and wrong. So any one of you who sees in that month should fast. Who sees in that month should fast, and anyone who is ill or on a journey should make up for lost days by fasting on other days later. God wants ease for you, not hardship. He wants you to complete the prescribed period and to glorify him for having guided you, so that you may be thankful. Prophet, if my servants ask you about me, I am near. I respond to those who call me, so let them respond to me and believe in me, so that they may be rightly guided. You go.
Yep.
You believers are permitted to lie with your wives during the night of fast. They are close as garments to you, and you are to them. God was aware that you were betraying yourselves, so he turned to you in mercy and pardoned you. Now you can lie with them. Seek what God has ordained for you. Eat and drink until the white thread of dawn becomes distinct from the black. Then fast until nightfall. Do not lie with them during the nights of your devotional retreat in the mosque. These are bound by God, so do not go near them. In this way, God makes his messages clear to people, that they may guard themselves against doing wrong.
Okay, so these passages are fundamentally the base of understanding the how-tos of Ramadan, but they also give us a lot of indication on like the importance of Ramadan, what some of this is about outwardly and inwardly. And so last week we kind of just did a breakdown of what a day would look like in Ramadan if somebody was starting from like the night prior going into the next day, and gave like a very cursory understanding of what all those different components meant. And so what I wanted to do today was get into a little bit more of the do's and the don'ts and to kind of distill from some of these verses, so that the same way when we were looking at wudu and we broke down the verse and then we talked about what were the obligations and what were the kind of recommended acts and what were things that were disliked to do, also in the course of Ramadan, understanding what these things are more explicitly and where they're drawn from, so that when we're engaging the Quran, we're also able to allow for it to have a more practical meaning for us. And then experientially, we can like take a little bit more from it. Does that make sense? How has Ramadan been so far for people? Like when you were talking about it in kind of the beginning part of the conversation, what has it been like so far for those who have been able to participate in different things? Yeah.
Majority of my nights have been like very quiet, like just in my schedule, like the way things work out. Like I'm by myself most nights doing iftar by myself. I've had like a couple nights. I saw you last week and then here and there, but yeah, a lot of quiet time.
And how is that for you?
It gets lonely a couple times, but which is odd because I'm typically like I'm cool roaming by myself all the time, you know. But I was chatting with somebody about it, and it's sort of like there's this whole collective, you know, there's this global thing that is happening, and yeah, I mean, in my first time, you know, practicing it, trying to figure out, you know, getting where I fit in, you know, I'm trying to figure that out.
Yeah, amazing. What else? How's it been for other people? Even if it's like more than your first time, you've done it before. How is it this year?
Backing off of, sorry, what you had mentioned, I feel like my nights have been quite the opposite. They're like so busy because I often come here for iftar and Tarawih, and then there's like qiyams and stuff and hanging out with friends and like building my relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in that way. And then I feel kind of guilty like spending alone time by myself in my apartment, which is like one of my goals to increase on, so I can like read more Quran and benefit in other ways than what I've been doing in the past few Ramadans. So I like appreciated what you said.
Anyone else? How's it been?
I think I've been a lot more mindful. I'm in school, so most of my days are just studying, and normally I don't think I realize how much I depend on like snacks and water and like candy. Like I'm just, my whole day is just like sitting at my desk, like eating, studying. So having none of that, it descriptor that I think has been like beneficial, but also lonely.
Lonely?
Yeah.
Lonely because like of no candy?
Yeah,
or
it's like I'm bored. I'm very bored.
You're bored.
But like in kind of in a good way. Like it makes me just even more mindful and like present.
Nice. Thank you for sharing. Anyone else? What has it been like? Yeah.
So coming back from Umrah, it has been like I feel like that trip has like been like a cleanse for me. And then like starting Ramadan like couldn't have been like a better time. So like spiritually I feel really good, but like I did get sick and I'm still like recovering from that, and like I was fasting while I was like still a little bit sick, so that was like kind of hard. But yeah, like day by day I'm getting better, so I've been doing that. But yeah, it's kind of hard. And then also with school, I kind of had like the hardest like rush of like schoolwork and like heavy load the week I came back from Umrah. So all of that just made things a little bit hard. But like, I don't know, I've just been making a lot of dua, so it like still kind of like it's not the end of the world.
Anyone else? Any thoughts? Great. So if we were to kind of just recap what a typical night into a day looks like. So what we said last time, right? Ramadan. Couple of things that we want to look at today, right? If we're looking at a typical Ramadan schedule.
Oh.
I think if we just lay them down. Where you're at now, the night like precedes the day in our tradition. So you have iftar, which is the fast breaking meal. You have maghrib. You have isha prayers. Iftarawih. We'll talk about each of these briefly again. And then you have suhoor, fajr, then you have dhuhr, asr, and then the thing repeats. And in the midst of all this, you're going to have work and school and class and sleep and everything else that is going on. What a typical day looks like in Ramadan, there's also now distinctions made over the course of the month and some other things that you want to think about. And then we'll talk about some of the practical ways that we can deal with some of these things in terms of exhaustion, tiredness, loneliness, because we're only in like day 6, right? Or something, or 7, or 5, one of those days. But there's still pretty much the majority of the month to go. And experientially, some of these things can catch up as we're kind of getting to a place of self-awareness, how we can better ourselves through them mindfully, but also you don't wanna get to a place where like a few days of loneliness is a lot different than a month worth of it. Do you know what I mean? And being able to learn from one another, how do we kind of shift paradigms to enable ourselves to get what we need throughout the course of this? So this is what a typical day looks like. When you get introduced to Muslim community, the way Ramadan functions as a month, we have a lunar calendar. And the start and end times of months are based off of like cyclical patterns of the moon, not
necessarily a solar calendar that many of us are used to, that also have fixed routines to them, right? So December is always when December happens. And you say, well, that makes sense. But in relation to Ramadan, Ramadan and every month in the Islamic calendar is 11 days or so earlier in comparison to the Gregorian calendar. So if my average lifespan of adulthood is like 60 to 70 years, right? Excluding when you're a baby or your child or anything, you know, pre-adulthood. So say somebody is going to spend, you know, 60, 70 years of adult living, you'll experience Ramadan probably for the most part twice in pretty much every time period of the calendar year, right? So you'll have twice, like in your lifetime, if you're Muslim your whole life, like 60, 70 years worth of Muslim living, you know, Ramadan will be twice in the summer, you know, in July, it'll be twice around Christmas time, twice whatever. Does that make sense? So what's happening, and what you want to be aware of as you get introduced more to Muslim experiences and Muslim community, most people don't pay attention to the start and end of any month other than Ramadan. And the way that months are determined are traditionally through two methods: a localized moon sighting or a global moon sighting. They're just seeing if the new moon has been born, right? A crescent moon to indicate this is the start of a month. So an Islamic month can be on average anywhere from 29 to 30 days. Sometimes you get the off chance of a 28th day. You don't have 31 days because if the moon's not sighted, you just complete a month of 30 days and then you just assume the next day is the start of the new month, right? Why is this important? Well, if you remember a few weeks ago when we read the article Islam and the Cultural Imperative that talked about just cultural diversity in Muslim communities and how it likened Islam and its relationship to culture to a stream flowing over a bedrock, that the water of the stream takes on the color of the bedrock upon which it's flowing, right? So Islam in China looks Chinese, and Islam in Malaysia looks Malaysian, and Islam in Sudan looks Sudanese. But we have the challenge here in the United States that people from all of those places live here as Muslims, and they intertwine their culture, right? Do people remember the article I'm talking about? Yeah? You okay? Great. No one knows what I'm talking about. So just like there's different cultural kind of diversities in Islam, you also have different opinions on things. And so some people will say the month starts if anywhere in the world they saw the moon. And that means if they saw the moon in any part of the world, then the month starts for everybody. And some people will say that you have to see it within a locale in order for the moon to be like sighted locally so that the month is there. And they'll cite narrations in the prophetic tradition where people would go to different towns and they'd be observing different months because they had the moon sighted in one place but not in the other place. But it's a literal like viewing of the moon by a naked eye, right? No method of scientific understanding, etc. What gets factored into this though is it has to be scientifically like possible for the new moon to actually be birthed, right? So somebody claims that like tomorrow I saw like the new crescent moon of the next month that's called Shawwal, right? Somebody be like, no, this is not fit, like scientifically possible, right? We're not in that phase of a moon cycle. Does that make sense? Why you want to know this is because like people argue over this quite often. You don't want to give yourself a headache. Whatever your local community is doing, you just kind of go with that. And they're both valid opinions and perspectives. But similar to when we talked like some weeks ago about the example I gave you of the guy whose friend was telling him about dogs and like watering apparatus, the lota, when you're using the bathroom, and that's what they made Islam into. There's certain things people just make Islam into, right?
It's a very beautiful practice in Islam. We have a relationship to nature, right? There's elemental aspects, right? We make wudu with water. We tell prayer times by the sun. It's actually a very beautiful practice to go see if you can sight the moon. And in many places, people would do this. If we had the capacity in New York City to take people every month to someplace upstate so you could actually see the moon, right? But as you're building traditions or like with friends and loved ones, you want to get to a place where you start to do some of these things and build that relationship. So you're actually looking up at the sky and you're sighting the moon and you can see it yourself. And then about, I don't know how long ago, but more contemporarily, people started to utilize calculations to determine the start and end of months as a way to recognize that, especially in this part of the world, that it becomes really difficult, that if you have to go based off of a moon sighting, the challenge that people would have is, I don't know when to tell my employer, like tomorrow's my holiday, but I would go and say to them, any one of the next 3 days could potentially be like when my holiday is, or you know, I can't potentially come to class or an exam or these kinds of things. So this was something that was also incorporated into it. All three of them are valid opinions, but they're associated with how a month starts and ends on an Islamic calendar. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. So the thing that I wanted to talk about today in reference to Ramadan, because we've gone through some of these things, and after I talk about the main thing I wanted to talk about, I want to talk about just some of the like do's and don'ts deriving more from the verses that we read. But there's a practice now that is embedded in Ramadan. So if you remember, when we looked at the verse that you just read that said fasting is related to what we called taqwa last week, right? A sense of mindfulness, consciousness. So there's a relationship between the external act and what it's meant to yield inwardly. And we had a few people talk about mindfulness in the course of how Ramadan's been so far. So there's a practice that is rooted in Ramadan in particular. This is called itikaf. That's traditionally done in the last 10 nights of Ramadan. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he would just seclude himself to the mosque. And this was a confirmed, like, prophetic practice. Men and women do it. It's something that has a very important kind of purpose to it. But essentially the idea is it's just overt seclusion. So in Islam, there is a regular spiritual tradition around the seeking of solitude, which is very different from like feeling alone or lonely, right? They're two different things. But solitude is a spiritual practice that our tradition is very deeply embedded on. But it's not a practice that's about being away from people. It's about being away from distractions, right? This idea of mindfulness associated with fasting, reading the Quran, and as a text, it gets associated with people who have mindfulness, right? People who have taqwa. So much of it is just about wakefulness and not realizing a state of just physical hunger, but seeing that nourishment is now more about the celestial self. And so what would happen in many places, right? And you could see this if you yourself come from a distinct religious family. Your family could be Christian, Jewish, Buddhist, Hindu, whatever it is that you are in as someone exploring Islam yourself, maybe like no faith affiliation, but you have familiarity with this. We have in our religious tradition indication from these different from individuals who we honor in Islam, but are also honored in other religious communities, that solitude was a regular practice of people who were serious about their spiritual diet. So the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, for example, he's seeking solitude when he goes to the cave of Hira. He's separating himself from the Meccan society. He's very deliberate in making time
in pursuit of just him being on his own. If you look at Moses, peace be upon him, he separates himself from the children of Israel for 40 days. Mary, the mother of Jesus, in our religious tradition, she seeks solitude and lives like in a temple at a time when, let alone, like, no women are doing that, like no people are doing that in that society. In the course of their solitude, this is where they also have really big experiences, right? So the Prophet Muhammad gets his first revelation in solitude. Moses speaks to God, you know, in that solitude. Mary, peace be upon her, gets like food from just nowhere appears to her in the temple while she's in the solitude. The idea with it also is that they're not seeing it as an escape, but as a means to enhance the reality that they find themselves in. So all of them go into solitude, but all of them also return back to their people. You know what I mean? Can you guys move up? Because otherwise people are gonna still come in to pray. So people can move in, so no one feels like they have to pray in the kind of corners of the space. Also, just if people are here for Dr. Marwa's halakha, it's upstairs. But you're more than welcome to stay here. We're gonna do this every Wednesday also. So in that course of solitude, essentially what's happening is that they are away from now societal distractions. This is what the i'tikaf is, right? It's a 10-night seclusion. And what's happening is you are both simultaneously consuming only what is good as you are diminishing the consumption of what is negative, right? This is what Ramadan in its totality is about. It's about gaining control over your consumption habits, but through all of your organs of sensory perception. And you want to think about this in terms of just distractions on a day-to-day basis. What do I mean by being away from distractions and not being away from people? The example I like to utilize revolves around a social experiment that was conducted by a man named Joshua Bell in the Washington Post. And Joshua Bell was put onto a DC Metro platform during rush hour, and he opened up a violin case and started playing the violin during rush hour, pre-COVID. And while he's there for a few hours playing on his violin, Joshua Bell says that in the hours he was there, pretty much nobody paid him any attention. An elderly man stopped for some moments and listened and then went on his way. He said when children, like, heard him speaking, they just stared, fixated upon him. And the adults that were with them had to, like, drag them away. And he said, I could see them looking at me over their shoulders. He said in the 2 or 3 hours he was there, he collected maybe, like, $10 or $20. And what made this crazy was that this man, Joshua Bell, he was considered to be one of the foremost practitioners of the violin in the world. That in those days around that social experiment, he had sold out concert hall after concert hall where tickets started at hundreds of dollars. The violin he was playing that day was valued at $2 million. And all of these people had the opportunity to sit and engage in this moment with him, but their hearts were being pulled by something else. Something else was distracting them, taking the attentiveness away from them. This was a moment, if they understood what they were privy to, they'd likely tell their friends about, their children about, their children's children about. But there's something that they are subservient to, and they're in this default mode of existence, right? The idea of the fast in our tradition is if you follow it based off of its mechanics, but then you also understand that just like we have a daily schedule, the days also are categorically distinguished. And the last 10 days of Ramadan are very distinct from the first 20 days of Ramadan. And so in those last 10 days, what was happening was the Prophet sought this solitude as a regular practice outside of Ramadan, you want to do it. But in the midst of Ramadan, he did it in this very specific way.
if you've ever done this as a practice, for those of you who have observed Ramadan before, has anybody actually done i'tikaf before? You've done it? How is it for you?
So, it's something that I seek every year, every Ramadan and every year.
Why?
Just as you said, you know, it's a game changer.
What did it do for you? So just so you know, I don't think you've ever been in this class before. There's people here who are exploring Islam, people here who are new to Islam. They've never, like, engaged in this before. So what is it, i'tikaf, like, for you? Why was it a game changer?
As you mentioned, you know, it's solitude. There's a lot of things that I've been distracted by, very engulfed in. I always wanted to change and, you know, always seek to, you know, cleanse that and, you know, change a lot of habits. And, you know, that was solitude of running away from all the distractions.
Great. How about for yourself? Don't say it was bad, by the way. Don't feel like it's terrible, because that's good.
No.
Throw off the clap. Yeah.
I think it showed a lot about how much of the world that we're consumed in, and you don't realize it until you step away from it. And that was like a true time that you can really isolate and kind of pivot your mindset and get close to yourself.
Yeah. And when you're in that space, essentially what's happening, right? When I was a freshman in college, Ramadan was around Christmas time. To give you an idea of how old I am, okay? And so it was the winter holidays, and I finished my exam, and I did i'tikaf for the first time in my life. I was 18 years old, and I went into a mosque in New Jersey, and I spent the last 6 days or 7 days there in the mosque. There's a lot of young people in the mosque at that time because of the winter break. But I went in leaving from the semester, and now all I'm doing is literally in a space of seclusion. It's filled with people, like more people that are in this room, like 3-4 times as many. So it wasn't about being away from people. But we're spending our days now all just in the mosque itself, unless there's a need to leave from the mosque for some reason, right? So if you have to use the restroom, for example, you go use the restroom, right? But not anything that's just, you know, I need to go for a random walk. I'm gonna go like play some video games. You're just in this place of spiritual seclusion. You can talk to people, interact with them, but you're praying all your prayers, you're hearing Quran being recited, there's people in the community that are making food for you to break your fast on, to have suhoor in the morning, but also you're not hearing like any negativity. Nobody's really gossiping, there's no lying or backbiting, there's not anybody being deceptive, there's not anybody being mean to one another, right? You're just kind of there in this space, and the consumption now is rooted in this notion that I am not away from people, I'm away from distractions. My heart now starts to get to a place where it can be focused on these deeper kind of reflective questions. Things that might be emotionally jarring, stresses that I have in my life, bigger existential questions, right? What is the Prophet doing when he's in the cave of Hira, right? What is Mary doing when she's sitting in the temple? And you think about how much of your daily routine has no stop to it. There's no break. But not only is there no break and that you're just constantly going, you actually feel bad to take a break. That I can't rest for some reason. I can't have a place where I'm just breathing, so to speak. When I went in to here 2000, when I was a freshman in college, into the mosque over the winter break, and then you leave now at the end of Ramadan, right? So the last, like, adhan for Maghrib is called, you pray Maghrib, and at that point, like, the i'tikaf period is done because Ramadan is done. And I walked out of the mosque, and the world just felt very different. And my parents said, what do you want to eat?
They took me to a halal fried chicken place because that's what I wanted to eat. And I remember as I left from the restaurant, I heard two people arguing. And just the sound of their voice in this state where their argument wasn't of anything that was really other than their egos fighting with each other, it like pierced my insides so much. I felt just terrible hearing it. I didn't want to hear any of it. And I went to them and I said, "What are you guys fighting about?" And it had something to do with shoes. I still remember. And I said, "Why is this something that you really want to be fighting over at this time, right?" And Allah forgive me, right? God forgive me. Because in that moment, I don't think it was purely for them, but it was really for me. It was really hurting me to hear it. And then when I got older and I could reflect back on an experience when I was 18, it was essentially like a detox of all of this negativity and what we become desensitized to and numb to. You know what I mean? But can create a different reflective point that says, if that's what's happening, if it's coming into me from somebody else, what must be happening if I'm the originator of it into the world? Do you get what I mean? And that's the whole idea with this fasting thing. The first layer is a fast of the physical, right? So its definition, we said last week, the word for fasting is sawm in Arabic, right? And it's about abstaining from something that's permissible, right? That's the idea. You're keeping yourself from something that would normally be allowed. So here now, you're not eating, drinking, or engaging in any kind of physical intimacy at like a more like sexual level with your spouse. These are the things you abstain from when you're fasting. But you use as an entry point the abstaining of what's permissible to get to a second level of fasting that is about the impermissible and staying away from that. But it's all rooted in this idea that you're reawakening your consciousness, your awareness, your wakefulness. You know what I mean? And so what the Prophet would do was he'd engage in this i'tikaf for the last 10 nights of the month of Ramadan, seclude himself to the mosque, and just be there. If you can't do 10 nights, that's okay. But if you want to anticipate for yourself that one, the intention of i'tikaf, the seclusion to the mosque, can be done at any point in time in the calendar year. You could go to a mosque and you're going there just to pray like the sunset prayer, the Maghrib prayer, and you can sit with the intention of this is also an i'tikaf period for me. If you can't get out the last 10 nights of Ramadan, you don't want to hate on yourself for it. It's not an obligation. But I'm saying this to you in the course of understanding how the month in its entirety functions. Like, what is it supposed to bring you to as an experience of not just the physicality of it, but what is it doing to you in all of your entirety, emotional, mental, spiritual, as well as physical kind of heightening and elevation. Do you get what I mean? So if you have a weekend towards the end of the month, then go and try to engage in some of this. If you're not able to do this in a mosque, right? And some mosques that you'll engage in by principles of their understanding of culture and gender, they might not have a space for women to do this. If that's not the case, it doesn't mean that you can't do it. But what you would do is in your home, just set up an area through which you will now be engaged in this kind of process of spiritual seclusion. You know what I mean? You try it for a day, but I'd say try to do it for more than a day, right? So if you have a weekend, you get out of work, get out of class on a Friday, and you go until like Monday morning, Sunday late night, because the first set of like experiences is gonna be similar to the first time you fasted, likely, and your head's gonna hurt, you know? And it's like, what do I do with my headache? I can't drink any coffee, you know? I'm like going off of this withdrawal. But as you get to it, potentially, for a good number of people, by like day 6, 7, 8, you're probably feeling different from the food aspect. Maybe the sleep aspect is a little bit throwing you off.
and other things, but from a food aspect and water aspect, it's likely different today than it was on day one, right? And so similarly, if you go into Etzikaf, minute number one is not going to feel the same way as minute number like 100 or like 200. So if you allow for yourself to be in that state for a couple of hours, what do you do in it? You can read Quran, you can make dua, you can sleep, right? Like you can literally go into the mosque and you can just sleep, but you're in a state of a place that has more metaphysical increase and blessing to it. But as a practice in Islam's spiritual tradition, this is something that was done quite regularly. And the important part to it is that when these people would do this, they would always come back to their people. They didn't use it as an escape. They used it as a mechanism to enhance the understanding of the reality that they find themselves in, right? What I'd like you to do just for a couple minutes is turn to the person next to you. Where do you go to find stillness? Where do you go to find solitude in your life? Not like loneliness, they're two different things. Where do you go to just reflect and contemplate? And if you don't do it, why do you think that is? And let's discuss and then we'll come back and talk about it. So introduce yourself to the persons next to you if you don't know who they are. And then we'll talk for a few minutes. And the solitude doesn't have to be in a mosque. So not just in terms of etzikaf, but in your week. Where's like your like sitting space? Where's a spot that you go just to think, to recenter? You know what I mean? Does that make sense?
I was very, 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 very,
Okay, so what are some of the things we're talking about? How does this factor into your life already? Something you do, something you don't do. Who wants to share? Maybe we can get a few people to talk about it. Yeah.
I was saying that normally my place of solitude is in nature, but ever since moving to New York, that's been removed. So, yeah.
Great. There's some like secret spots I could tell you, but don't tell anybody. I want all these people in my face when I'm in my secret spots. Yeah. What else? Yep.
We also were talking about like being outside. One secret, not so secret, but that we connected on was that we find water very like peaceful, or at least it gives you a way to kind of be with yourself, but doesn't feel totally stagnant. So that's like very common. Like going to the water.
Great. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah.
Or about like time of day, like 6 o'clock, like right around then, stepping outside, because the city hasn't like fully woken up yet, you know? Like it's just a different kind of quiet.
Most of us don't have regular moments of stillness. This is a challenge in the prism of modernity. There is an ever-diminishing nature to places of stillness and just finding stillness in our lives. So what Ramadan is very big about, inculcating within oneself a sense of wakefulness, a sense of reflection, the importance of contemplation, and it's built into this ritualistically, because you're not just thinking about eating food, but you're thinking in relation to how you eat food. You see what I mean? Do you see the difference in the two, right? You have awareness, and it builds itself up now into these things. One of the things that you'll find in Ramadan is in the last 10 nights, there's specific mention. So if we go back to the Quranic verses that we were looking at, in verse 183 in Surah Baqarah, that's like the basis of the mandate of fasting in Ramadan. And then we'll look at these really quickly. 184, it says, fast a prescribed number of days. Ayyam ma'dudat, it says in Arabic. The word ayyam is a plural of the word yom, which means day. But Arabic grammar has a lot of different kind of forms to it. So the word ayyam is a plural, but it's a plural of paucity, right? It's like it's saying it's more than one, but it's a few. Right, and they're kind of prescribed. So there's not so many days to it, right? It's saying like, it's just a small number of days. If you ask a lot of people, as much as it feels like Ramadan's been now forever, it also feels like it's going pretty quickly, right? It goes fast, but is experienced also slow, like somehow paradoxically, but it's a set number of days. And as it continues on and it talks about some exemptions now, and these are things that we can go into in more detail, but for the purposes of like a foundational class, if you're sick or you're traveling, you're not required to fast. These are concessions made for people in that instance, right? My 7-year-old, my 10-year-old, they're not required to fast to begin with. You're required to fast if you are adult, sane, and Muslim. These are like the general understandings of who is mandated to fast in Ramadan.
And then there's exemptions that are drawn from that. So if you fit into those categories, you fast, and then you have certain situations where you're not required to. So my son, he got sick, and then my wife got his sickness, and the illness that she had was very dehydrating. So the doctors said, don't fast. And it's not easy, because a lot of people want to fast, but then she still didn't fast, right? Because you actually can get to a point where it's prohibited for you to fast if it's becoming now detrimental to your life, but it's an exemption. And for some people, it's a lot harder to actually sometimes do what's easier than doing what's difficult. Do you get what I mean? As if you feel like you're doing something that's wrong, right? It doesn't mean that if you're traveling or you are sick that you are required to not fast, but the option is there. Traveling, and we'll talk about this when we start to talk about prayer and what goes into prayer, there's different opinions on what constitutes being in a state of travel. So it doesn't mean that I could say, you know, I traveled from my office to the prayer room, so I don't have to fast today, right? That's not what it is. But in the Hanafi school of thought, it's 48 miles of a distance that once you exceed that, you are in a state of travel if you are not intending to reside in the place that you are traveling to for a period that is 15 days or greater. The travel time is not incorporated into that 2-week period, right? So if I left from New York and this weekend I'm gonna go to Michigan and North Carolina to speak at some humanitarian fundraisers, so I can go to North Carolina, and because I'm traveling, I am exempt from fasting. The ease of the travel is not the catalyst for the exemption or delegitimizing it. But the verse says, if you can fast, that's better for you, right? So I'm gonna fast this weekend. Does that mean that if, you know, we went together and he was another speaker at this thing, he's also a grown man, let's conceptualize, right? And he said, I'm not gonna fast. Can I be like, oh my God, you're the worst Muslim in the world, astaghfirullah, Allah is gonna punish? No, right? The verse says that when you're traveling, it's one of the instances you don't have to fast. Does that make sense? Yeah, any questions on that? Because it is like what it says, right? And this is where people draw this from. It's one of the things. If you cannot fast at all, like you don't have the physical capacity to fast. Say I have a chronic illness. I'm diabetic, I have a mental health condition, I need to take medications during the day. Our fast does not allow for the consumption of anything. So if somebody says you can take a tablet while you're fasting, you can't. Like it breaks the fast, right? It's still consuming something. You drink water with the tap, like all of it breaks the fast. So if you have a chronic ailment and you will never be able to fast again, then there is what's an expiation. In lieu of the fast, you would pay for people who are in need, one meal for two people a day or two meals for one person a day, right? So essentially 60 meals over the course of the days that you would miss, 30 days. Does that make sense, right? If you have an ailment or condition that is not chronic, you can make it up at a later time. So say in the summer, it's hard for me to fast because I have to take medicines in certain intervals. But in the winter time, when the day is shorter, I can fast at that time. Then all I would do is fast at that time. There's a concession at that point. Does that make sense? That's what this is saying. At one point in the Islamic kind of experience in the first generation of Muslims, people had the option of either fasting or paying what was called the fidya instead of fasting. Then it wasn't an option. You were required to fast, and only if you could never fast again. There's different opinions on this, but in the Hanafi school, if you have the capacity to fast at a later time, or the condition you have will allow for you to fast later, then you just make up the fast later. Does all of that make sense? Okay, So if we continue, the next verse talks about Ramadan being connected to the Quran. And this is something that is a big part of Ramadan. The listening, the recitation, the engagement of it. And so you want to utilize Ramadan as this way to have access to it in that sense. And then interestingly, there's a verse in between all of these rulings where God says, when my servants ask you, O Prophet, about me, tell them I am truly near. I respond to one's prayer when they call upon me, so let them respond with obedience to me and believe in me. Perhaps they will be guided to the right way. Why do you think that verse is there? In the midst of these verses that are talking about the do's and don'ts of fasting, why is there a verse now that is saying, O Muhammad, tell people if they ask you about me that I am near to them and that I'm answering their prayers? Does that make sense, the question? If you could turn to the person next to you and just talk about this. Why is this verse in the middle of these verses around the do's and don'ts of fasting? And then we'll come back and discuss. Don't say only what you think is the right thing. Don't avoid saying something because you think it's the wrong thing. Don't also lecture the person you're talking to. Just listen as people are speaking. But why is this interjected into these verses of do's and don'ts? And then we'll come back in and talk about it. Go ahead. So verse 186, how does that fit into verse 183 to 187? Okay, so what are some of the things that are coming up? Why do you think this verse is there? What are you discussing? You got it. It's okay. Like, the Quran, pretty much on every page, invites its reader to think, you know? So you don't want to be intimidated to think. It's also okay if you think and then a conclusion you reach might be a little bit off. That's fine, right? Because you want to be scared to think. You know what I mean? You want to be at a place where you're able to utilize your critical thinking facets. Some of what goes into religion is not just logically deduced, you know? So I couldn't tell you why we pray three cycles of prayer at sunset as opposed to four. I don't think anybody could tell you other than that's just the way God said to do it. But some of these things we do want to ponder upon, right? So why do you think this verse is in the midst of these verses? Anybody? Yeah.
We talked about how the verses prior were like rules, like a lot of rules, and they can be hard for some people, like whether it's like a sick person that like really wants to fast but like their body won't let them, or if it's a person that like struggles with that, or, like struggles with like abstaining from the things outside of just fasting itself. And we were just talking about how like it's probably just like a reminder that like you can turn to Allah if things are like getting like too difficult for you, or like, yeah, that's basically it.
Okay, great. Anyone else?
Adding on to that, I think it's just a reminder that Allah knows your intentions. So yeah, it's basically it. Like he knows what your intentions are, and if they're pure, like there's nothing that like stands in the way between you.
But the verse is saying, O Prophet, tell people if they ask you where I am, tell them I'm near. Right, I'm close to them. And when they call upon me, that I am responding to the calls of the one that calls upon me. I'm hearing the prayers of people, right? I hear this question constantly, right? How do I know that God is hearing my prayers, right? Because he's telling you he's hearing your prayers. He's listening to them. He's responding to them. He's accepting them. But in the context of this in Ramadan, any other thoughts where people land? What did you think about? Yeah.
Structurally, I was like thinking analogous. I don't know if anybody's ever like run a 5K before, and like I know I've definitely seen people like start out with all this like banging intention and like jazz, and then they get like halfway through and they're like, what am I doing here? You know, like they're feeling some kind of just the weight of the endeavor. And so sort of like structurally in this, it's sort of like a connection back to that in that intention and the divine because in struggle and can be something you need to.
So between this week and next week, just think about it more, right? And keep coming back to it. You know, the idea with the verses in the Quran are not that they're meant to be read once, or you just understand legal rulings from them, but you can extrapolate so much more from it. And read through these 5-6 verses and think about what they say to you that has nothing to do with anything ritualistic or anything that has to do with just do's and don'ts. But what else do they have to do with, right? What else does it like speak to me about? I want to say one last thing before we head upstairs. So I wrote down now next to the last 10 nights. In the last 10 nights, there is a night that one seeks out that's called Laylatul Qadr. So in verse 185, where it says, شَهْرُ رَمَضَانَ أَلَّذِي أُنزِلَ فِيهِ الْقُرْآنَ, that the month of Ramadan, in it is the kind of revelation of the Quran. Laylatul Qadr, which translates as the night of power, the night of destiny, that's said to be the night in which the Quran was revealed. There's a prophetic tradition where the Prophet gathered people to tell them what this night of power was. Because there's an entire chapter in the Quran, in the last part of it, that's called Surat al-Qadr. The chapter talks about this night, Laylatul Qadr, and it says that it is equivalent to 1,000 months of worship, if you were to worship on this night. And in the hadith, where, if you remember, we said a hadith is referring to an action, a saying, or the tacit approval of the Prophet Muhammad. So if he said to do something, he did something himself, or he saw you do something and didn't say, don't do that. This all fits into this kind of genre. So in this one hadith narration, he comes to tell the people of what the night of power is, what its day is. And two people are arguing in the crowd. When the Prophet comes out, he said, I intended to tell you what the night of power was, but because of the arguments of these people, right, the negativity they interjected, that knowledge was lifted from me. And he then has subsequent narrations that say to seek it out in the odd nights of the last 10 nights, to seek it out in the last 10 nights on a whole. And so you'll find Muslims doing this, right? If you come in Ramadan, it's your first Ramadan, you're exploring Islam, you're going to come to the place, you're going to see people, and they're going to, in the last nights, like stand in prayer a little bit more than they would. Some will stay up until the dawn prayer, Fajr, just trying to seek out worship on this night. The idea is that it's a night in which what your destiny is impacted through the observance of it. It's a very auspicious night, a very holy night. Mosques around the city will stay open and have special programs in those nights. There's not like a right or wrong in this. If you're a person that kind of feeds off of people's energy, then feed off of people's energy. If you like your space and you just like to kind of do your own thing, you could do this in your house, you know? But the idea is that in those last 10 nights, you want to use a part of it to just engage in some kind of prayer, etc. And it's attached heavily to the Quran. So next week, what we'll do is kind of pivot from some of this where we've talked about wudu and we've talked about fasting, you know, and if people have specific questions on fasting, we could talk about those also. But I want to move back to like conversations on foundational theology. And so if we could talk about the Quran, for example, like revelation, how does that all kind of come to be? How does the Quran come compiled now into the form that we have it? Just so people have some baseline understanding on that. And then we'll start to talk about just the elements of prayer, the do's and don'ts, like what goes into it, the timings of prayer. For those who have not been here on a Wednesday before, pre-Ramadan and after Ramadan, we typically do an Islam 101 class for people who are new to Islam, exploring Islam, people who are trying to just rebuild a base, like relationship with the foundations. So we started this in January and we've been going through things slowly. And we'll continue to do it on Wednesdays in this room at 6. There's a concurrent program happening upstairs in the hall that we typically pray in and break fast in. That Dr. Marwa Asar does a halakha as well that you're more than welcome to attend also. Does anybody have any questions or anything before we head up? The time to break fast will be in like 4 or 5 minutes. Yeah.
So for the itikaf nights, say someone intends just for the weekend or for the whole 10 nights, I know that cleanliness is important in Islam. Would you like bring extra changes of clothes? Or
yeah, you could bring clothes with you. There's most mosques that allow for you to do itikaf are going to be spaces that have like showers built in the basement, maybe one or two. There's gonna be like other stuff as well. You should bring like a sleeping bag. Right, some warm clothes because it's still cold, you know. You could bring food for yourself and whatever else. If you have friends, they could bring you like things also. But you'd want to like find a space that you're also comfortable in. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, but it's like you're camping out, right? Except you're camping out in the mosque. I don't know if that sounds like it would be fun or not, but it's a really transformational experience. But also, if you can't do it in a mosque, you can't find a mosque. Like in Manhattan, there's not really a lot of places that do this. This wouldn't count as a space to do it because this isn't considered legalistically to be a mosque, right? It's a prayer room. We call it musalla. But you can do this in your homes, right? In the absence of mosques, right? Or circumstances, whatever they might be. And we talked about this when we read Islam and the Cultural Imperative. And I mentioned it before too, but especially for the women who are here. Some of the mosques that are here, they won't have spaces necessarily that are very adequate for women, unfortunately. Yeah. Okay, so why don't we take a pause here? People want to go up. If you just put the chairs against the wall, because Sheikh Fawaz is going to come to pray here with the Shia community. We want to make sure they have adequate room for that.